Welcome to Science Questions. I am Sherry Quinn.
And I am Susie Montgomery. For most of us, no matter how far removed, the words back to school conjure up strong and lingering images. Stiff new threads, new shoes, blazers and plaid, the crunch of crisp leaves, cooler nights, and the anticipation of new commitments. A fall fresh start. This week, Science Questions is going back to school and heralding two exceptional science teachers who are doing far more than just dusting off the old textbooks.
If ever around Salt Lake City, you spotted a large yellow biodiesel school bus conducted by a slight, curly-headed woman, or you witnessed this same teacher using her large voice to solicit vegetable donations for school lunches at the local farmer's market, then you have been privy to Slixy biology teacher Shay Wilkelson. She and her middle school elective biology class are busy blending up various school lunches and fast food happy meals, tracing the carbon content and testing for corn in everyday food to determine the origins and health issues surrounding these conveniently tasty meals. Slixy 10th grader Josh explains.
High corn diets are directly linked to obesity, diabetes, and high blood pressure. And if students today are favoring high corn diets, then we could see an increase in these diseases.
If we are what we eat, what are we? Wilkelson asks. An essential question for this project called Untangling the Food Web. The project got underway last fall with students investigating and mapping the food, specifically fruit, in their environment.
Peppers, cherries,
crab apples,
plums.
Oh yeah, crab apples.
We're trying to identify the amount of fruit-bearing plants in our neighborhoods.
Okay, and so what did you do to do that?
I started at the end of my street, walked 4 blocks down Davis Boulevard, and counted all the apple trees and all the edible plants I could see.
I'm Jacob Robinson, and I found a flowering plum. A plum that isn't planted for the fruit, it's planted for the beauty of it during the spring. And I believe I found some apricots down the road and some tomatoes possibly across the street.
My name's Anna.
Okay, what'd you find, Anna?
I found peppers, carrots, pumpkins, tomatoes, apples, apricots, plums, and pears.
A food web ecologically is, of course, all the organisms in a given community that eat each other, that eat, you know, plants, that get eaten by other things, that get broken down by decomposers. But the human food web is so big and so complicated now that our community is generally the entire globe. Different parts of your food can come from all over, and it's increasingly really hard to actually track and trace and to measure our impact. The fruit in your neighborhood is something that's fairly easy to track compared to where we get a lot of our food, and it's a good time of year to track it. It's also a good chance to introduce terms like transects and taking population data, and right now we're just working on understanding the scientific method and writing conclusions and graphing data and those kinds of things.
Wilkelson had the students tracking, graphing, and picking fruit, not only to develop their rudimentary skills in executing the scientific method, but to orient them in their community. They became neighborhood distributors of fruit, supplying fellow schoolmates, community members, and the food bank. As the project moved along and the fall fruit gave way to winter, the students teamed up with University of Utah scientist mentors. After school, they would hit the lab at the U of U to work, furthering their understanding of the composition and origins of the food we eat. One of the projects, conceived by two ninth grade girls, looked at the health discrepancies between natural grass-fed cows and industrial corn-fed cows, the latter the cause of some serious health issues.
Cows are actually physiologically designed to eat grass, not corn. So when cows eat corn, they tend to have different problems. They need more antibiotics. This is where E. coli, the bad E. coli, actually evolved, was in this corn cow stomach environment.
Middle schoolers Jade and Jasmina took to the tedious task of determining whether the beef labeled grass-fed was really grass-fed. First, they did a little research. Jasmina explains their project they called what's really in your beef, getting down to the isotope.
While you're raising something industrially, you're using growth hormones, synthetic chemicals, all sorts of things that make it less healthy. So your health benefits tend to decrease. So with grass-fed beef, you have more omega-3 fatty acids than you would in the industrial beef, as well as studies have shown that with the grass-fed beef, it's better for your immune system. And industrial beef, it's being fed corn, so that means that you're eating a beef that has been eating corn, and corn is linked with conditions like diabetes and high blood pressure.
Looking at different carbon isotopes in the beef, such as carbon-12 and carbon-13, would tell them what the cow had been eating, where detection of C13 would indicate the cow was a corn eater.
So in order to test this experiment, we got 12 different beef samples, six of which were labeled to be grass-fed and six were industrial raised. And we got our samples and we had to freeze dry them with liquid nitrogen in order to get them ready for the vacuum. And when we put them in the vacuum took out all the liquid, so then we can later on grind them and get them ready for a mass spectrometer. And after we got them out of the vacuum, we had to add in more liquid nitrogen in order to be able to grind them into a fine powder. And then we took 0.5 micrograms of each sample and put them into tiny tin capsules that then we had to combust, because in order for your mass spectrometer to get a carbon reading, it has to be in a vapor. So the vapor would enter into the mass spectrometer and it would hit an electron beam, and the electron beam would shoot electrons at your sample. So then your sample would become a positively charged ion, which would then accelerate towards an electromagnet, and the electromagnet would then change the trajectory of the samples. So the heavier ones would come closer in towards the magnet, and the lighter ones, so carbon-12, would go farther out. And at the end, you have little plates that read how many times an atom has hit it. Then you get a reading of how much carbon-13 and 12 is in each sample.
The results showed how Smith's, Whole Foods, and Tony Caputo's compared.
This color, the red, is the Smith's grocery store. And what was interesting with that is that the organic beef, what it says it was labeled organic, but it wasn't grass-fed. So not always does organic mean grass-fed. It means that the corn it was eating was organic. And also, the ones from Whole Foods are labeled, they have a rating system, 1 through 5. 1 being that it doesn't meet the Whole Foods standards, and 5 being it is pasture-raised, grass-fed, and all-natural. And that shows on the graph that they were telling the truth with that. And
another thing, the beef samples we got from Tony Caputo's, one of them rated the highest for eating C3 plants, so that means that you're getting really good grass-fed cows as well as local cows, so then you have 2 benefits right there.
At Tony Caputo's food market in Delhi in downtown Salt Lake City, we caught up with Matt Caputo, son of Tony Caputo, behind the counter. He is the marketing director and aficionado of cheese, olive oil, and all other fine Italian specialties.
So the reason why we don't just go with one is because we're talking about small farmers who don't have enough available all the time to keep us in constant stock. However, when people come in and want to shop here at Caputo's, they came in wanting ground beef, or they came in wanting New York strip loin, or you know, something like that. They have to be able to find what they came in here for. But it's important to us to be able to deal with these smaller farmers who we have the opportunity to go out to their places, visit them, see what they're doing, talk to them about their practices, and really, to me, it's in the end, it's all about flavor and what that connecting to that flavor of, you know, how things tasted hundreds of years ago. I think it's a much richer experience, both just for gustatory enjoyment and, you know, for as a cultural practice too. So I think one of my strongest assets as a buyer here is the fact that I've been around the block a long time. I look young, and I'm only 31 years old, but you know, I've been in the specialty food business literally since I was 5. And before that, my dad and our family, in fact, there was a Caputo store in Rose Park. I think they wrapped up shop probably in the 60s or thereabouts. but they were the first refrigerated deli case in Utah. They were a little back in the days where food was purchased at your corner store instead of at a mass supermarket and things like that. So it just feels like it's been in our blood.
And Matt says you don't have to be an expert to taste the difference in quality between the meat sold at Caputo's versus grocery store meats.
Any person on earth, regardless of their experience in meat, they don't have to have some expert palate. If they take home a packet of Kirkland hamburgers and take home some of that ground beef from Pleasant Creek Ranch, say, and do the exact same treatment of both things, all you have to be is alive to be able to be bowled over by the difference. It is a big, big, big difference flavor-wise. What I really get a thrill on is taking people who aren't even part of this food culture necessarily and who are interested in it, but are kind of a little bit intimidated by it, and inviting them into it and showing them the difference in a way that's not elitist. That's not like, oh, I'm a connoisseur and I love this to lord my knowledge over everyone. That's not at all what it's about. And I think that's what kind of sets our staff apart and why we're able to make these picks and connect with people on these products, whether it's beef or cheese or whatever, is because we do it from a place of passion and wanting to be inclusive. If they wander in here, we want to share with them. It's a great, you know, confirmation of what we're trying to do here, and not just in the fact that we won, but the fact that there's two ninth graders that came up with this study, and I think that in itself is the true victory. I think the fact that these young people are interested in it is absolutely everything for the economic stability of Utah, because I don't think it's in, this is where I'll get into political trouble, house farms out in the South Valley where it's like these huge developments that, you know, don't make sense from a service standpoint of getting like actual power and water, and then they take eminent domain of actual farmland out there. I think it's more important to plan for agriculture, plan to protect those sort of things, and unfortunately right now I don't think it's being done to the extent that we need to do it. But I think with young people like that, the future is looking like it's going to keep getting better and better, and I think we're headed in a really good direction. I'd love to get in contact with those two incredible young women and see if they're interested in coming to a tasting class on us and delve down this rabbit hole of specialty food and excellent production practices even further. I think they'd be pretty into it, and it'd be our pleasure to do something like that for them. I think it'd be fun.
That's it. Congratulations. Great. On winning the healthiest meat.
That's awesome. Okay. The more that we promote it, I think the more that we can affect change in the broader marketplace. So it's a good thing. Yeah.
The students added purchasing grass-fed beef costs on average $1 to $3 per pound. And for now, they reassure us we are not being taken to the cleaners.
We would like to do special thanks to Luciano. He let us use his lab up at the University of Utah, and he gave us guidance of how to do things, and he was the one who did all of our mass spectrometer readings. And then Leslie weighed our samples. And then we'd like to thank Ms. Wickelson for supporting us and helping us, and then always taking us up there every day after school.
Are you proud of the results?
Oh, I think they've done a fantastic job. I am amazed at they have put in a ton of time in class, outside of class. They've been up at the university a lot, running samples up there. They were wicked smart kids to begin with, and now they're wicked, wicked smart kids. So,
all right, well, let's go. Our next stop was down the hallway to hear about a corny study done by three middle school-age boys.
Hayden, Josh, and Jacob are looking at how much corn overall is in school lunch, and they've taken school lunch samples from a bunch of different schools, and they're comparing that to student preferences for taste. So corn is kind of an indirect measure of how processed our food is, because there's a lot of processed things that are actually made out of corn. in general. And so they're kind of tracking that.
We believe that if we test the amount of corn in each of the school lunches we collected, that the school lunches the kids favored the most would have more corn than the school lunches the kids favored the least, because based on studies, there's a lot of high fructose corn syrup in a lot of lunches. There's high amounts of cheap corn in the food, so if we're able to get that cheap corn in our bodies and we start to like it, we could expect to see that people like it more. Like, there's a lot of high fructose corn syrup sweetener in different foods, so people could find foods with corn in it more appealing than foods without corn.
The young scientists completed the analysis using the same methods as Jade and Jasmina described earlier, weighing and encapsulating the microsamples and examining the isotopes in the mass spectrometer, determining the amounts of carbon-13 and carbon-12 in their samples, ultimately revealing the healthiness of our food. And what did the boys find out? Well, their data for West High School lunch, including items such as a cheeseburger, macaroni and cheese, or chicken fajitas, showed all items tested in the C3 producer range, meaning there was a lot less corn in the lunches than their hypothesis suggested.
First, we gathered lunches from West High, our school, and Newman Elementary, and then we blended the individual school lunches, and then we froze them and labeled them, and then we went up to the U of U, and we freeze-dried the fruit, which is basically you freeze it, and then through sublimation, take out all the water. And then we grinded up the samples using a mortar and pestle.
The reason we're looking at these two isotopes is because there's two types of plants, C3 producers and C4 producers, and corn is a C4 producer, which means it takes in both carbon-12 and a lot more carbon-13 than a C3 producer. And a C3 producer would be like wheat or rice or any grass. And so based on the ratio of C13 to C12 in your samples, you can tell how much corn is in it. The trend on this graph just kind of is flat. It doesn't have any trend at all, actually. And if our hypothesis was correct, you'd see one going from the shortest and to the tallest, from favorite lunches were more corny to least corny.
There's no correlation between favorite and least favorite lunches. And also, they aren't very corny, so.
I'm not so sure if I missed this or not, but what part of corn makes it such a leading food obesity causing?
It's the corn by, like, what they make using the corn. So, like, high fructose corn syrup is a really big one.
Another thing is that it's just so much corn at such a cheap price. All the unhealthy foods are now less expensive than, like, vegetables. You can buy a dollar hamburger, but you can't even buy a head of broccoli for a dollar anymore. It's just that corn prices have gone way down and all the other vegetables have gone way up because of being outcompeted. And so just corn's a lot cheaper because of overproduction.
So something we were pretty surprised about was that we kind of expected that we would see a lot of corn in school lunch, and that would kind of be a measure of school lunch is maybe having a lot of these processed additives. But really we found out that school lunch was pretty more in that C3 range. It didn't have as much of the carbon-13 isotope that we would have expected to see from corn. So that's great. It reflects well on school lunch. We also got a fairly tight data set. So the school lunches all fell within a fairly specific range in terms of the isotopes. And so something we decided to do was to test other lunches, fast food lunches or processed lunches from the store, to see what those ended up looking like comparatively. So we'll go out and we'll buy some Happy Meals and blend those all up in a blender. And then we'll look at the isotopes there.
And they did. Six of the students joined Wickelson for 2 weeks this summer to collect and prepare enough samples for publishable research comparing the carbon isotopes of school lunch and fast food. The students designed key elements of the experiment, picked apart some journal articles, wrote hypotheses, and picked some cherries along the way. Their samples are in line for the mass spectrometer, but haven't been analyzed yet. SQ Radio is on standby for the results to find out if fast food meals are chock full of corn products, and how fast food compares to school lunch.
Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery reporting from Slixie.
It don't matter anyhow. Ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe. If you don't know by now, when your rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window.
Teachers have the power to positively influence a student for the rest of their lives. It is a job that deserves respect and should not be taken lightly. Pat Shea, an associate research professor of biology at the University of Utah and a private practicing attorney, knows how impactful teaching is in all of our lives. And it would be an understatement to say Pat Shea's road to education is winding. He started with a degree in intellectual history, attended Stanford, was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, where he studied genetics and animal behavior, and then got his law degree from Harvard.
I was the first in the family to go to college, and so my father's favorite question was, so let me get this straight, you're studying the history of ideas, and what kind of job is that going to get you? But that's what I did.
He has taught at Kansas State University, BYU, U of U, and Westminster. He was also head of the Bureau of Land Management during the Clinton administration and ran for Senate against Orrin Hatch in 1994.
Of all those jobs, where does teaching science fall? Where does being a professor fall?
If it paid enough to pay the mortgage, it would be the highest priority.
Professor Pat Shea is currently designing a course called Biography of an Urban Stream at the University of Utah that he will teach this fall, focusing on the Red Butte Canyon and using the oil spill in June of 2010, when an estimated 35,000 gallons of crude oil spilled from a fractured Chevron pipeline into the Red Butte Creek system.
Tell me about the course you've recently designed and what inspired you about it.
Well, I got a phone call in June when the first Chevron oil spill happened, and it was the Dean of College of Science, Pierre Sikorsky, who I've worked with for over 10 years. And he said, I think this is a teachable moment.
Pat Shea agreed. Lessons could be learned from the environmental insult of the Red Butte oil spill. He designed a course for upper undergraduate and graduate students with a twofold mission. The first to show students the integration between hydrology, biology, and geology, where students can see the scientific and mathematical tools that have proliferated in the last 10 years. The second goal of the class is for students to understand that the future in science is going to be multidisciplined and require the cooperation of public and private sectors. Essentially, no single entity is capable of solving these major environmental crises, and multiple organizations need to assume the responsibility for remediation rather than pointing fingers. He uses the BP oil spill as an example. In the classroom of Red Butte Canyon, Pat Shea will teach the students that managing wilderness from this holistic perspective is as important as managing our urban areas.
So if you go to the headwaters of Red Butte, you're at 9,500 feet, and you're amongst pine trees, conifers, and large snow and temperature variations. And then as you go down, and what this class is going to do is go down at 150 meters or 200 yards each class and examine what the flora is, both native and non-native, and how they're interdependent. I think a lot of times a person will see a tree or a bush or a grass, and they'll think of them simply in that species context, but there is an interdependency. So I'm hoping that the class will be a bit of a busman's tour through the world of science applied to a very specific geographic area that's literally in our backyard.
You've explained that we have so much information on the canyon. It's been studied since 1910. And now, why is this a teaching moment?
Well, I think it's a teaching moment because it brought people's attention in this information-cluttered world we live in on one particular place, Red Butte Creek. And I think that draws people's attention away from their routine. And for me at least, those abnormal or unusual moments I remember more clearly than the normal moments. You know, you don't necessarily remember which glass you used to get a glass of water last night, but if you broke the glass, then you remember. And so I think this was, if you will, a broken glass moment that hopefully will get people more curious about their neighborhood, about the ecosystem that supports them.
Pat Shea may take the edge off a little by turning this devastating oil spill into a learning experience, not only for the students, but also for the community. Private entities, in this case Chevron, are still in partnership with Salt Lake Public Utilities and the university to refine their emergency handbook to one that is shared, where all parties remediate the damage as a team. Chevron staff, professors from the three science disciplines, and Public Utilities Director Jeff Niermeyer, whom Pat Shea refers to as a superb leader, will all be part of the class, providing students with an ongoing case study in both science and policy making.
Politics is the study of human dynamics, and I'm a firm believer that human dynamics are determined in part by the biology of the actors. You know, that just as the three-spined and ten-spined stickleback or the Rhode Island red chickens I studied had behavioral characteristics, or more importantly with my children, it is amazing to see the behavioral tics that you see in your kids that are hardwired. Part of the attraction to me about biology is scientific methodology is a intellectual rigor where you have to verify what you're asserting as your hypothesis. And I think all too often in politics, we assert things that are, upon critical examination, not true. Whereas in science, if they're not true, they're going to be proven to be not true. And in politics, we tend to let them float. So as I get older, I find more comfort in scientific methodology than I do politics. I always, when I teach, make it abundantly clear what my own political leanings are, so that people will be able to calibrate what they're hearing to what they think they should be hearing. And I always invite opposing points of view, because I think that's another instance, another teachable moment where there's conflicts of ideas, and you as the listener have to ascertain who's telling the truth, who's not telling the truth, who do you agree with, who do you disagree with. And instead of just having sort of a monotone lecture, I'd much rather have a dialectic back and forth with the students.
Pat Shea has been a teacher for 36 years, and he has not only been a maverick in the educational arena, but in the political one as well. He served as head of the Bureau of Land Management under President Bill Clinton, has taken on many freedom of the press cases, and as a defense attorney for activist Tim DeChristopher, recently jailed for derailing a federal oil and gas leasing auction. Pat Shea vowed to appeal the sentence he called a serious abuse of justice. He fosters integrity and has always been looking around the corner, a natural curiosity he hopes to inspire in his students.
I grew up wanting to be Lewis and Clark, and exploring canyons as a kid was my form of recreation. My cousins and I would go up Mill Creek Canyon or up Little Cottonwood Canyon or up City Creek Canyon. And there was just always something around the corner. You know, there was another part of the stream, or there was a beaver pond, or there was, you know, a weasel or a muskrat or something, or there were birds that were fascinating. And to have people in the class share with me the enthusiasm for the natural setting, I think, will be what I'm searching for, and to hear their questions.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. Thank you for listening.